Good evening, this is Panacea, your health program, coming out every Tuesday night. I'm Quentin Strawley. How much lead do we still have in the environment? Should we be concerned? And also, public acceptance of science. And Russ will be talking about the vital element of vitamin K. And why water plumes on Jupiter is so exciting. All coming up next half hour.
In a society inundated with technology,
one podcast will set out to document the weird, the wonderful and mind-boggling stories of the digital age. Think. Digital Futures.
Finding the human in the machine. Tune in 6:30 p.m. Tuesdays or 10:30 a.m. Sundays.
Brought to you by the University of Technology Sydney and 2SER 107.3.
One of the early awakenings as a baby, not we remember it, is where we used to have a vitamin K prick, but nowadays it's a drop, I understand. And obviously, vitamin K is a vital thing for a lot of things, including perhaps helping us later on in life. Let's turn to a regular contributor, Russell Setwright, who's a practicing naturopath. Russell, tell us all about vitamin K.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. We're looking at people on dialysis and looking at vitamin K levels and different types of problems associated with cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
And what they came up with, which I thought was very interesting, was that vitamin K was found to reduce the incidence of calcium buildup on the artery walls.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But then reading right through their information, they said, of course, what they've found is low vitamin K, even in healthy young adults, led to a 3.3 times increase in the risk of developing a heart attack later in life.
Wow.
And also, at that age, there was a reduction in the pumping efficiency of the heart because it was building up calcium on the sides of the arteries. Now, we do know that calcification of the arteries is one of the biggest problems we've got. And, you know, a lot of things are blaming it on too much calcium or whatever. What we've found is that vitamin K is absolutely essential for regulating, along with vitamin D and other minerals too, but absolutely essential for regulation of calcium moving in and out of the bones. And what we've often talked about in the past is cell dumping. In other words, if you haven't got all the nutrients there, you can end up with it depositing instead of being excreted, excess.
Right.
And apparently vitamin K helps the movement in and out of the bones, but if it's not enough there, it'll dump the calcium in the cardiovascular system, which leads to hardening of the arteries, narrowing of the arteries, and reduced efficiency of the elasticity. But even in young adults, now where do we get our vitamin K? From our 7 servings of fruit and veggies that everyone has every day.
Right, okay. So it's not just the folate, it's actually the vitamin K as well.
That's exactly right, you know, and of course that helps regulate blood clotting as well, and that's why it's given to bubs at birth. But what we're seeing is more and more evidence of these nutrients causing problems associated with later in life, with serious problems like heart disease, and we're not seeing anything being done about it. All we're getting is, oh, well, eat a balanced diet and eat more of it. Well, the fact of the matter is that only 10%, I think it is, of people eat 7 servings of fruit and veggies a day.
Yeah.
So we're talking about 90% of the population is not getting that diet. So what do we do? Do we just say, well, we won't tell them that they could supplement to help them out that way. We'll just say, you've got to get the diet right or you're going to die, and let them die. Is that what we're going to do? Seriously, we've got to give alternatives. There's a reason for this. It could be cost of the veggies. It could be a lot of people don't like the taste of them. There are many, many reasons why people aren't doing it, but the fact is they're not doing it. We want them to change. We're encouraging them to change, but it's not happening. And I liken it to speeding on the roads. Some people, believe it or not, Quentin, you may have, I don't know if you've noticed it, but some people drive over 60 kilometres an hour when they shouldn't.
Yeah, yeah.
And even though there are big signs, police cars with lights on the top and advertising going on, a speedo in their car, and they can get fined for doing it, but they still do it. So what we've got is people don't pay attention to lots of things. And if they're going to do that, getting to eat their fruit and veggies. Now, we've just got to go back to basics and look at kids. A lot of kids didn't eat their fruit and veggies when they were young, and mums and dads then gave them something else to make up for it. Quite often it was a glass of fruit juice, thinking that'd do the same, which, of course, it didn't.
No.
And so they've grown up with this change. But if it's going to reduce the incidence of having an early heart attack, that's going to save billions of dollars in the health system. And that would certainly pay for it. But I don't see anything out there saying, make sure if you're not eating these, and we're telling you to eat it, and nothing replaces a good diet, and we want you to have that diet. But if you're not doing that, you should be supplementing with your calcium, vitamin D and vitamin K to help reduce, one, osteoporosis, but also to help with regulation of the calcium deposits so that you're not going to have an early heart attack. As we know, it's going to be beneficial for osteoporosis. That's going to save money, but it also can be beneficial for the heart, and that can make a difference because 80% of women, in some of the studies I've looked at, don't get enough calcium.
No.
So we're not dealing with a minute bit of the public where we can say, look, just get them to fix up. We're dealing with a substantial majority of the public that are not doing things correctly. And is it that we're not giving them the message correctly? Maybe it is. But in the interim, as we have with folic acid in pregnancy, you must take it to help prevent neural tube defects. As we found with putting iodine into the diet by adding it to salt, which they said, whoops, that's not good, we've got too much salt. But we do know they've got to add it because they're just not getting it. We now need to look at other things as well, but please don't go along and say, let's just stick it in a loaf of bread.
Well, no, I'm just thinking, you're talking about calcium uptake. I mean, I still hear people prescribe Caltrate, which, of course, we know is calcium citrate, which is inappropriate anyway.
Absolutely, and the reason for that, and I remember back in the pharmaceutical days, was it was more easily absorbed on a low-acid stomach, which elderly people were. But they didn't. But then again, so what? It's absorbed. It didn't do much for the bones and deposited in the arteries, so it wasn't very good, was it?
No.
But that's not what they looked at. They only looked at absorption. And really, it's a combination. So there are good formulas out there with the vitamin D, the vitamin K, and the calcium together. And what people often thought, oh, the calcium's a bit high, and that's I'm getting calcification in the arteries, so therefore I've got to cut back on my calcium, which is going to, of course, increase the risk of osteoporosis.
Yep.
But that's not what it is. It's a matter of you're not getting enough vitamin K. Eat a lot more leafy, green, dark veggies. And if you're not having those huge servings of those, then at least look at a supplement. But don't leave it as doing nothing, because the evidence is pretty strong on this one.
And the obvious question is, do we ever get any vitamin K in fast food?
I very much doubt there's any at all. The waffle dust amounts of veggies you get in that, I use the word waffle dust being it's a sprinkler virtually out of a spray can, isn't it? Not much. It's not going to do anything. And it's the dark green ones that you're looking at. So, you know, I don't think I've ever had anyone order a spinach sandwich. Maybe they do.
Who knows? Could be an entire new market.
It could be.
Thanks, Russell. Russell's a practicing naturopath in New South Wales. Russell Sitright, you have a really good week and we'll catch up next.
Absolutely. Thanks, Gwen. All the very best.
Discover your creative future at the National Institute of Dramatic Art. Whether you want to perform on stage or screen or work behind the scenes, NIDA has a master's, bachelor or diploma course for you. Come along to NIDA Open Day on Saturday, June 16 from 9 to 4. Watch classes, meet NIDA alumni and see student performances for free, followed by Q&A with cast and crew. Register to attend by searching NIDA Open Day. NIDA sponsors 2SER.
Lead was once a common element in everyday life, but it was phased out and removed. Or was it? Dr. Susie Rushman joined the Daily to discuss how much of the hazardous material is still in our environment.
Firstly, how dangerous can lead be when people come into contact with it?
Yeah, so it's how much you're in contact with. So there's lead naturally in the environment at very low levels. And that's fine. It's when you're exposed to high concentrations of lead for ongoing periods of time that it can be an issue.
How prevalent would you say is lead in the environment today compared to that of probably a couple decades ago?
Well, a few decades ago, we were still releasing quite a lot of lead from leaded petrol. And we were in the phasing out stage, so there was still a lot of new lead coming into the environment from leaded petrol, whereas we phased that out in 2002. A couple of decades ago too, we'd also already stopped that really high concentration of lead in paints, and so that was another high exposure for lead in our environment. And then in the last few decades, you know, our in control of industrial lead, that's pretty much stayed the same. We've got to go back quite a few decades for there to be where we didn't have good control on industrial lead being released into the environment.
Yeah, right. I wasn't actually quite sure that I'd never heard of leaded petrol before, and I never really got the difference between unleaded petrol. I thought that was just what it was called. I never realised that lead was in our pet. What would have that, if we hadn't changed our practices from leaded petrol, would that kind of impeded our environment today? Would it be a different kind of, would there be health risks, I guess?
Yeah, so that, lead was taken out of petrol because of the environmental and human health risks from it. They were noticing, particularly people who lived near main roads, that there were health impacts on them. So the decision was taken to remove the lead from our petrol. It was there as for anti-knocking properties and as a lubricant in the petrol.
Yeah, wow. So I guess another question for today is, in what form does lead still enter our environment today?
Well, we still have quite a legacy from old sources of lead that had entered the environment. So lead, it's an element, it can't break down. So once it's in the environment, it just sort of moves around. A lot of in sort of older areas in cities and towns and areas that were close to roads, people will often have elevated lead in their soil from that historical exposure, even though there's no new lead or very low levels of new lead coming in. We still do have small amounts being released into the environment from industrial sources, and they're our main sources of lead.
Yeah, right. Mining is obviously another large contributor of some of these dangerous materials. Mm. What are some of the environmental impacts of this mining?
So there's in Australia, there's definitely been around some of our larger lead mining areas like Broken Hill and Mount Isa. There's been documented impacts on people living in those areas, and those mines now work to minimise those impacts. Most of that lead isn't moving outside the immediate area of the mine, the immediate sort of vicinity of the mine, though.
Yeah, right.
They're unlikely, you know, if you live in Sydney, you're unlikely to be exposed to any significant amount of lead coming from, say, Broken Hill.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's good to hear. Are some of the ways we can reduce the impact of some of these mines?
Well, definitely, I think there's, you know, we have guidelines that are already in place for how much lead it's safe to release out into the environment. And so following those environmental guidelines that are in place is the biggest thing that the mines can do. There's the people who live in the vicinity of those mines. There's been quite a lot of research done, and they have guidelines around certain behaviours to make sure that they minimise their exposure to the lead. So things like when you're vacuuming, if you've got lead containing dust in the house, when you're vacuuming, depending on the type of vacuum you use, you could re-entrain that dust up into the air and breathe it in.
That was Dr. Susie Reshman.
The Oxford Art Factory is turning it on this winter with a diverse program to get you out and about seeing the best live music in Sydney. Get involved in some of Vivid Festival's best highlights, including Stonefield, Reggie Snow, Noah Kahan, Wes the Barton, Columbus, Klo, and many more. To buy tickets and check out the full Vivid program, or find out about other great upcoming shows, head to oxfordartfactory.com. Oxford Art Factory sponsors 2SER.
It takes more than just a robust science to convince people to take on a certain point of view, especially if you consider the controversial topics like vaccination, genetically modified foods, and climate change. A recent study examined how a balance of evidence can shape the likelihood that people are convinced into a psychological phenomenon known as the diversity effect. Brett Hayes, a professor of psychology from the University of New South Wales, joined the DRIVE team.
Great. So can you talk a little bit about the diversity effect and what was involved in the study?
Yeah, sure. So most of my work involves the psychology of human reasoning, and the diversity effect is sort of a basic principle of human reasoning that we've known about for probably 20 or 30 years. And what we were really interested in this study was to see whether we could use that basic principle of human reasoning to help guide people towards better science communication, particularly in sort of areas where there's a lot of science controversy, like in climate change and in some areas of public health. So the diversity effect, the simple version, works in a pretty straightforward way. The basic idea is that people on balance are more convinced by evidence that come from very different kinds of sources, very different kinds of backgrounds, than they are for evidence that comes from very similar sources. Now, the simple version that we've sort of been studying in the laboratory for a long time sort of works like this. Let's say you wanted to discover whether all birds have some kind of novel feature that you've only just learned about. So whether all birds have sesamoid bones. Now, most people don't know what a sesamoid bone is. They don't need to know in this case. It happens to be a little bone that's encased in cartilage. But the question is, what kind of evidence is going to convince you that all birds have sesamoid bones? Well, in the simple case, you might learn, say, on the one hand, that sparrows and robins have sesamoid bones. And you might think, oh, okay, that's interesting, but it's not that convincing because sparrows and robins are pretty similar. They're those little birds. If you learn that they have that property, you might think it doesn't really generalise very far. But if you learn that sparrows and penguins have sesamoid bones, they're really, really different kinds of birds, then you're more likely to believe that this is shared, that this is a property that's shared by other birds. So that's the diversity effect in the simple form. People are more convinced by that very different kind of evidence from different sources, different locations, than they are from similar kinds of evidence. So what we wanted to do is to see whether that scales up to real science and the sorts of science that science communicators are really concerned that we understand. So we basically did a version of the diversity effect, but using real scientific facts about, say, climate change and public health. So we gave people, say, evidence about rising sea levels from either very similar locations like Australia and New Zealand, or very different locations, Australia and the UK. And on balance, people were much more, and then they had to decide whether or not this was better evidence that for global climate change. And in general, the diversity effect did scale up. People were generally more convinced by that sort of diverse evidence from different locations or different societies than they were about more similar evidence.
Why do you think that climate change deniers' movements kind of gain traction or increase in plausibility among the public? Is this one of the reasons because they can't really grasp the esoteric nature of scientific studies that are released?
Well, that's a big question. I guess I'd say a couple of things. First of all, there's a range of views out there in the public about climate change and the degree to which humans are contributing. Of course, the science is pretty solid. The science is pretty solid that global climate is warming, and that human activity, like fossil emissions, is a really big part of that, a really big contributor. Most surveys suggest that about 60-70% of Australians do believe the climate's warming and do believe that humans have got something to do with it. Probably about another 20% are sort of in the very, very much uncertain category. And it's really only about 10% of people who are sort of hardcore climate deniers, although, of course, it's a pretty vocal minority. So we would say the sort of work we've been doing is really aimed at trying to convince those people who are sort of still unconvinced, the people who are sort of in the middle and wavering. It's going to be much harder to use just the basic principles of science communication that we've been working on to convince the hardcore 10%. But we think it's probably more important to reach the sort of middle ground people who are probably a little bit concerned about climate change, but not fully convinced that the science is as solid as it actually is.
Right, and so do you think that this psychology-driven method of influencing audiences will become the way to release evidence in the future?
Well, I think it's a big question to communicate. Climate change is a pretty tricky problem, and it's a big ask to get people to understand all of the science, and because it is pretty complicated. But I guess our view is every little bit helps. If the sort of work we've been doing just improve the people's acceptance of the science, give science communicators a slightly clearer guidelines of how they can present the evidence in a way that people might find a little bit more convincing, then we think that's a good thing. Obviously, that's not going to work for everybody, but like I say, I think there are a variety of strategies we have to try to communicate climate science better, and this is just one of them.
That was Brett Hayes, Professor of Psychology from the University of New South Wales.
Think digital futures.
Stories from the digital age.
Today's technology transforming tomorrow.
Sundays on 2SER 107.3.
Or you can catch the podcast. Subscribe to Think Digital Futures now on your podcast app of choice.
Where there is liquid water, there may be life. For years, the US National Aeronautics and Space Administration have been searching for evidence of plumes of water from the Jupiter's smallest moon, Europa. And now they think they've found it, after a reanalyzing data from 1997 flyby of the Europa by the Galileo Jupiter probe, NASA has good reason to believe that the plume of water from the icy surface gushed forth into space. To figure out what this means, Sam Barron talked to Jonathan Horner, Professor of Astrophysics at the University of Southern Queensland.
To figure out what this could possibly mean, I'm joined by Jonathan Horner, Professor of Astrophysics at the University of Southern Queensland. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
That's all. It's a pleasure. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, absolutely. So why on earth do we care about liquid water spurting off the surface of Europa 20 years ago?
Oh, it's very, very exciting for me. I mean, on the one hand, one thing that people are perhaps not talking about much is what value we can get from data that was taken in the past once we look at it with new eyes, once we look at it with new knowledge from other missions. So this is something that people kind of noticed when they had this flyby 20 years ago, didn't really understand, and it's just sat there as a bit of an unexplained puzzle for 20 years. In the 20 years since, we've learned a whole heap of things. We've learned that Saturn's moon Enceladus has geysers erupting all the time from its south pole, spewing material into space. And we've learned kind of how those geysers would interact with a spacecraft when Cassini flew through them. We've also found hints that Europa could have these kind of geysers, these kind of eruptions every now and again using the Hubble Space Telescope, with eruptions thought to be seen in 2012, 2014, 2016. But those were right on the edge of what Hubble can detect. You're really pushing it as hard as you can. So you put all these things together, and then you go back and look at the data from 21 years ago, and suddenly it makes a lot more sense. That's really exciting.
So we'll return to the Europa and the water plumes in a second, but why were they able to derive this from the data now when they couldn't before?
There's a few reasons. Firstly, to understand something, you've got to know what you're looking at. So an extra 20 years of scientific knowledge is going into this, which makes things clear and makes it a lot more straightforward. Another thing that's playing a role in it, of course, is thanks to the flyby that Cassini did of Enceladus, where it flew through a similar kind of plume, we now have a much better handle on what that kind of thing would do, what it would look like. And that's why you can look back at this and say, actually, that looks like it's the same kind of thing. And you needed to develop fairly complicated computer modeling to study how material ejected from the surface of Europa would interact once it's in the vacuum of space near Jupiter, interacting with radiation from the sun. And that kind of modeling just wasn't possible 21 years ago. Computational astronomy has come along a huge distance in that time.
Now, obviously, we have the ongoing Curiosity mission on Mars, where they're trying to investigate sort of, the existence of liquid water and life in Mars' ancient past. Are we going to see something potentially similar for Europa, or is it the idea that we can kind of see it from space without having to go down to the surface?
We're working towards it. Europa's a lot harder to visit than Mars. Mars is not as easy to land on as the Earth, but it's still fairly straightforward. It's got an atmosphere that can slow you down. You can use parachutes and things like that to get you fairly close to the surface. You can bounce around, you're all good. Europa has no atmosphere. So to land on it is really, really challenging. You know, if you're a few meters above the surface, you're still traveling at 100 of kilometers per hour, and that's bad.
Yeah.
And also, it's much harder to reach your orbit further away. And it's orbiting Jupiter, which is the most nasty, toxic radiation environment in the solar system, which damages your radiation. And I think we talked before about the wonderful Juno mission, flying around Jupiter, which has all of its instrumentation in a 100-kilogram titanium box to try and shield it from that radiation. So it's a big engineering challenge. The middle ground, the next step on the way, is a proposed mission called Europa Clipper, which may or may not happen depending on the current administration or the next administration in the US. But the idea here is to send a spacecraft to Europa to go into orbit around Europa. And that would do two jobs. One would be to actually map Europa in great detail to kind of pave the way for a lander maybe 20 or 30 years down the line. That's kind of the timescale we think of in astronomy. But the other thing, of course, would be to look at things like these plumes and be able to go around Europa, in orbit around Europa, and fly through repeatedly, map the surface, map where the plumes are, taste them, sample them, and learn more about what they're coming from.
So
that's the beauty of this for me. You have liquid water being jetted out of the interior of Europa, which means suddenly we have a way of accessing the ocean that we think is underneath the ice cap without us having to drill through 15 kilometers of solid ice to get there. If we can sample the bit that's squirting out, we can learn a lot about what's going on the inside.
Well, what kind of things can we learn about?
Well, you can learn about the chemical composition for a start, and that's offering hints at what's down there, which, from the point of view of life elsewhere, you know, we have this kind of basic recipe for life that's life like the Earth, where you have liquid water, you have a source of nutrients, and you have a source of energy fundamentally. If you can sample the plume, you can test what's been carried out with the water. And even if you can't find a direct signal of life, you can get a feeling for what other things are in that water. It's not going to be pure water, it's going to be rich in something. In terms of the source of energy, you may also find hints to that. So one of the big exciting results from the final flyby of Enceladus that happened just before the spacecraft around Saturn crashed into the clouds was the discovery of molecular hydrogen in the plume. Now, a tiny little moon can't hold on to molecular hydrogen, it would just escape really quickly, which means that hydrogen has to be produced somewhere. There has to be a source making it at the current time. That's suggesting a chemical reaction's happening that's producing hydrogen, which means that the only way they can think of that working is to have hot water in contact with rock, which means you have volcanism. So there's your source of energy and your source of nutrients. And they're the kind of things we could uncover by repeatedly flying through these plumes and tasting them, sampling them, and learning what they're made of.
So, Jonathan, all this is kind of, again, it's based off, you know, 20-year-old data. They've gone back and revisited it, reanalyzed it based on current knowledge. Do we see a lot of this, or are we going to be seeing more of this as we go forward with the computing technology and so forth?
I think we will, and I think it happens more than people realize, actually. If you go back to my own field that I love the most, which is the small bodies of the solar system, the first Centaur, the object I studied for my PhD, was discovered in the late 1970s. It's an object called Chiron. And they found it, and it's got this peculiar orbit between Saturn and Uranus. And within a few weeks, they were able to tie that orbit down really precisely, because once they knew that it was there, they could go back through archival images and observations and find it and track it back further in time, which meant within a couple of weeks, observations had been found of it that were nearly 100 years old.
Wow.
So they made use of this archival data to actually do the science really quickly. There are even suggestions that Neptune, which was discovered in the mid-1800s, was actually first found in 1610 when Galileo was looking at Jupiter and it was in the background. And people have used those observations to suggest that maybe Neptune was discovered a lot sooner than we realize. You know, so this kind of accessing ancient results and looking at them with a new lens is a very useful tool. It's one of the things in our armory, essentially.
That was Jonathan Horner, Professor of Astrophysics at the University of Southern Queensland, talking to Sam Barron.
The ones we love, celebrating the music of REM. Join the all-star lineup of vocalists from Tea Party, The Church, The Go-Betweens, Die Pretty, The Clouds, The Hummingbirds, and more as they perform REM classics. September 7th at the State Theatre. Get your REM celebration tickets now from the State Theatre or Ticketmaster. Metropolis Touring sponsors 2SER.
A And that music means we're out of time. You've been listening to Panacea on 107.3. I'm Quentin Strawley. Let's make a date next week. Coming up is A Question of Balance.